on WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM. Well, today, over 1,000 people are marching, rallying, driving through Pakistan, protesting the unmanned aerial drone attacks that have killed hundreds of civilians in Pakistan. The march is led by superstar cricket champion and now politician before election Imran Khan, who created the PTI, or Movement for Justice Party. The Pakistanis are joined by about 30 peace activists from the U.S. and England. Their stated goal is reaching Pakistan's semi-tribal areas, Waziristan. Pakistan's government forbids them to enter those territories where the U.S. has assassinated people using unmanned drones, apparently with the government's tacit backing, although that's denied in public to Pakistanis. In the Dawn newspaper in Pakistan today, former Foreign Minister Qureshi, who defected from the main ruling party to join that PTI party this year, has said the march would not be a failure if the authorities stopped it from reaching Waziristan. He says the government's saying we are against drones. The people are saying we're against drones. What are they afraid of? Why are they blocking us? I'm very glad we have with us two people today to take a look at this. Nafisa Hoodboy is a journalist in the United States and a staff reporter for many years for the Dawn newspaper in Pakistan up until year 2000. Welcome, Nafisa.
Thank you.
And we're also very happy to be joined by Robert Naiman, Policy Director of Just Foreign Policy, based in the United States. Robert Naiman is on the ground in Pakistan on this march. Robert Naiman, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Robert Naiman, I just want to start by asking you in particular where you are with the march at this point along the road toward Waziristan.
I'm on the bus. The march... it's really more of a convoy than a march. We're not walking from Islamabad to Waziristan. We're taking vehicles. So I'm in a bus with 32 other Americans on our way from Islamabad to Waziristan. We started out about 9 this morning, and it's now almost 9 o'clock p.m. Pakistan time, so we've been going for 12 hours. The plan is to stay just outside Waziristan, just outside Waziristan tonight, and then cross over in the morning, assuming that we are allowed to do that, which we're still hopeful we'll be allowed to do. Although, of course, we've heard all the rumors that everyone else...
In the cities that you've traveled to along the way, there have been rallies with thousands of Pakistanis along the way. Have you spoken to them? How did they react to the presence of 30 Americans in Pakistan?
Well, we had a limited exposure because we weren't allowed to leave the bus for security reasons. However, we did get to see people along the way, and many people greeted us very warmly, you know, with their hellos and their peace signs, and we flashed them our peace signs back and tried out our Urdu slogans on them, which seemed to make sense, you know, stop drone attack in Urdu, which we've been taught is drone hamle bunkaro. So the reception has been very warm. Yeah, you're laughing at my Urdu.
but anyway,
we have to start somewhere. So we've had a very warm reception. We've been here now, most of us, for about a week in Islamabad. And quite a few people know we're here because we've been on TV. Medea Benjamin has been on Pakistani TV. Anne Wright has been on Pakistani TV. This is commonly reported in the Pakistani press, Dawn, and other newspapers. Not only is the, I mean, this is front page news that Imran Khan is organizing this huge rally, and the PTI are organizing this huge rally in March to Waziristan, but also that there's this contingent of Americans, a big part of the story, and that's being reported in the Pakistani press. Our participation, our meeting with the U.S. Embassy, the U.S. Embassy urging us not to go, us telling the U.S. Embassy, no, we're going, all of that is been reported in the Pakistani press. So people see us, and not only are they like, oh, some Americans, they know which Americans we are. We're the Americans that came to Pakistan to join in the protest against the drone strike.
Nafisa Hood-Boy, you've, of course, reported in Pakistan for many years, now based in the United States. Could you give us some of the background about how Pakistan, the range of reactions among Pakistanis to what's been happening in the last 10 years that have brought us to this point? I know that's a huge period to cover, but how do you see Pakistanis reacting to the drone strikes in the tribal areas, typically against Al-Qaeda and Taliban, but of course the vast majority of Pakistanis having nothing to do with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda?
I think, you know, Pakistanis generally welcome the peace delegation from the U.S. because they're hoping that through this, the U.S. activists will be able to convince the U.S. administration to stop the drone attack. So by far and large, there's a great deal of welcome. But frankly speaking, I don't think people are very optimistic that this is really going to change anything because they know that this is official policy to have drone attacks. And a few activists coming would not really change things. So that's the general sense I get.
And from Pakistanis that you know and have spoken to, how wide is the understanding that there are people in the United States, whether they're minority or not, opposed to these unmanned drone assassination strikes against targeting Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, but also hitting hundreds of civilians, killing hundreds of civilians so far?
I think people in Pakistan tend to know.
People in Pakistan tend to know that. Do they tend to know that in the United States there is a anti-war movement opposing the drone strikes? Is that something that people are typically aware of?
Well, the thing is, people in Pakistan know that the anti-war movement is rather small in the United States, given that, you know, the media is global, and so people in Pakistan watch what's happening in the United States. So they know that there isn't that kind of opposition to drone strikes. And because people do watch CNN and they do know that people haven't come out openly in the United States or in the West to oppose drone strikes. So they're not exactly encouraged, you know, by the resistance here.
By the resistance in the United States, because, of course, the drone strikes continue. And just to ask you again, Nafisa Hood-Boy, in your work reporting, is it a widespread sentiment in Pakistan, would you say, opposing the United States, not just drone strikes, but war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in those tribal areas of Pakistan along the Afghanistan border?
Well, of course, I mean, the broad majority of Pakistanis would say that it is the innocent people that are getting killed. There's been, you know, 307 drone strikes in the last so many years, 2004, I think they first started. And according to statistics we have, roughly about 800 civilians have been killed in that. So nobody in Pakistan supports the drone strikes, particularly people who live in the Fatah areas and in the Waziristan areas. It's also, you know, the drone strikes have forced thousands of people to migrate from Waziristan, and North Waziristan has become an area where nobody can enter because the militants have now got control of the area. So overall, just the fact that the Fatah areas have been turned into war zones with daily bombardments and, you know, missiles coming from outer space has totally terrified the population. It's given nightmares to children. It's turned people into, you know, psychotic cases. And so, of course, nobody can support that.
And Robert Naiman, there on the ground, on the bus, on the road in northern Pakistan, I wonder what you've noticed about all this, and is there an awareness of the petition that you're bringing from Americans to give to the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan?
Well, this was reported in the Pakistani press that we got
that we delivered this petition with more than 3,000 signatures, and also this letter from prominent Americans, Noam Chomsky, Naomi Wolf, Danny Glover, Oliver Stone, in opposition to the drone strike, specifically raising the issue of the civilian casualties, demanding that the U.S. government come clean on this, demanding that they end the signature strikes that are targeted against nobody in particular, and the secondary strikes, the follow-up strikes that have killed civilian rescuers. This was all reported in Washington, in the Pakistani press, and in fact, we got video from it, which we circulated on the Internet, and I wrote about this in Huffington Post, posting transcripts as well as the video. So I think we did make a little splash. There was follow-up interviews with some members of the delegation on Pakistani TV. I think we broke a little bit of ground. You know, the history is
particularly people who live in the Fatah areas and in the Waziristan areas. It's also, you know, the drone strikes have forced thousands of people to migrate from Waziristan, and North Waziristan has become an area where nobody can enter because the militants have now got control of the area. So overall, just the fact that the Fatah areas have been turned into war zones with daily bombardments and, you know, missiles coming from outer space has totally terrified the population. It's given nightmares to children. It's turned people into, you know, psychotic cases. And so, of course, nobody can support that.
And Robert Naiman, there on the ground, on the bus, on the road in northern Pakistan, I wonder what you've noticed about all this, and is there an awareness of the petition that you're bringing from Americans to give to the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan?
Well, this was reported in the Pakistani press that we got. That we delivered this petition with more than 3,000 signatures, and also this letter from prominent Americans, Noam Chomsky, Naomi Wolf, Danny Glover, Oliver Stone, in opposition to the drone strike, specifically raising the issue of the civilian casualties, demanding that the U.S. government come clean on this, demanding that they end the signature strikes that are targeted against nobody in particular, and the secondary strikes, the follow-up strikes that have killed civilian rescuers. This was all reported in Washington in the Pakistani press, and in fact, we got video from it, which we circulated on the Internet, and I wrote about this in Huffington Post, posting transcripts as well as the video. So I think we did make a little splash. There was follow-up interviews with some members of the delegation on Pakistani TV. I think we broke a little bit of ground. You know, the history is that U.S. officials have refused to talk about this program at all, claiming that it's classified, or when they, in the rare occasions when they said anything, it was just the vaguest, you know, broadest, most meaningless assertions that the program is successful, that it's narrowly targeted against the list of top terrorists, that the civilian deaths are exceedingly rare, according to John Brennan. Well, you know, in fact, the recent Stanford NYU report found that top-level targets represented 2% of the deaths from drone strikes, whereas somewhere between 400 and 800 civilian deaths since 2004, that's like 7 to 14 times as many civilian deaths as deaths of top-level targets. So it's actually the opposite. The thing that's been exceedingly rare is the killing of top-level targets. But what hasn't been exceedingly rare is the killing of civilians. So I think it's having some impact here in terms of the discussion here, which I think matters because there has been there's a kind of fatalism in Pakistan, in much of Pakistan, about this. There's nothing we can do. You know, this is the Americans and this is the Pakistani government. So I think this is a new element, the fact that there's now this vocal U.S. Opposition to some Americans, not necessarily every American, but, you know, we have to start somewhere. I think the overwhelming fact is that most Americans have no idea what's going on. So whatever judgment they're making it on the basis of essentially zero information. recall that between 2006, 2008, there was no debate in the United States in the war in Afghanistan. Now the overwhelming majority of Americans oppose it. The same thing can happen with drone strikes if Americans get information about what's actually happening.
As you pointed out, importantly, the British Bureau of Investigative Journalism has analyzed and reported somewhere between almost 500 to almost 900 civilians killed in those United States drone strikes in Pakistan in the last 8 years. Out of about 2,500 to 3,300 people killed overall, as you point out, the high-value targets, as they put it, the apparently accurate strikes, if that's what they are, on al-Qaeda leaders, only 2% of those drone strikes, people killed in drone strikes, 2 out of 100 people were actually among those high-value targets. And as you point out, in case people couldn't hear you over the phone line, somewhere between 7 and 15 times as many civilians have been killed as those high-level targets. Certainly brings into question whether these are surgical strike weapons by any stretch of the imagination, these unmanned aerial vehicles. But I want to move on to a different question. I want to ask you both this question. It's a very important one, and I appreciate both your answer. I'm going to start with you, Robert Naiman, because you're on the ground there in Pakistan while we have you on the line. Given that we've just established that many Pakistanis do understand because of global media that there is a U.S. anti-war movement opposing drone strikes, given that many Pakistanis are not backers of al-Qaeda or the Taliban, the vast majority of Pakistanis, why is it you think, Robert Naiman, that your group of 30 Americans, peace activists, opposing the drone strikes, delivering these petitions, opposing the drone strikes from prominent Americans, which has been widely reported, which many Pakistanis know about. Why is it that you can't get off the bus, that you're unwelcome in those areas?
Well, it's not a question of being unwelcome. I think it's a question of being in an area of Pakistan where there are, you know, longstanding security issues, including just, you know, petty crime, and where an area where Americans don't travel. So being sort of ostentatiously a group of Americans in such an area is kind of attractive news. It's reported to us that there's a lot of crime along this road. And it also has been, you know, reported in the press that, of course, it's all kind of rumors. But one thing that was reported was there was supposedly the State Department received intelligence about a threat of a suicide bombing on the rally. So, of course, it takes only a small number of people to do something extremely nasty. So I think the overall popular reaction has been very positive, but that doesn't necessarily stop some determined group of hostile people from doing something nasty. So because of that, we're being circumspect, because none of us obviously we want to protect ourselves, but everybody else in the convoy, we don't want to be a provocation for an attack that would hurt somebody else.
And Nafisa Hoodboy, did my question make sense to you?
Yes, I mean, but the fact of the matter is that anti-Americanism in Pakistan is extremely high. Now, you know, what are the causes behind that? We know it's the long-term U.S. presence in Afghanistan and the fact that, like, 40,000 people in Pakistan have lost their lives, including 7,000 U.S. soldiers. So, and the economy is in shambles. So whoever you want to blame that to, of course, it's been a total mismanagement of the war by the Pakistan military as well as the Pakistan politicians. But that makes people victims. And, of course, you know that whenever people become victims, it's very easy for them to target the other, you know, people who don't look like them. And so, I mean, I would be concerned, you know, if I was from the U.S. and went there, because then I would be a symbolic target. And I think the administration has rightly taken steps to protect people who've come from the United States, because, you know, the last thing you want to happen is for people who are peace-loving and humane to become targets by the militants.
I wonder what your thoughts are to Nafisa Hudboy about Imran Khan. He's a superstar celebrity, a cricket player known to perhaps virtually all Pakistanis and even people around the world who follow cricket in different countries where it's a major sport. He's also a politician. He's run for election. He has an election coming up, if I'm not mistaken, next year. He's chosen to sort of take the lead or put himself in the lead, perhaps, on some of this kind of this march and project of raising awareness in Pakistan. I wonder, do you see it as a productive political project for all of Pakistan, or primarily as a pre-election celebrity project for Imran Khan?
Yeah, I mean, I see it clearly as a political step. I mean, the fact of the matter is that he is taking people into South Waziristan to the area of Kotkai. Now, Kotkai has been known as the birthplace of the primary suicide bomber, Qari Hussain, you know, who launched a series of suicide attacks on the rest of Pakistan. It's also the birthplace of the head of the Tehreek-e-Taliban, Hakimullah Masood, who is still on the run. And to take people from the West into the heart of suicide bombers doesn't strike me as very sensible. Imran Khan knows that most of the attacks have happened in the north of Waziristan. There have been 307 drone strikes, and 238 of them have been in north Waziristan. So why not take people North Waziristan? And the fact of the matter is, North Waziristan is totally in the hands of the Tehreek-e-Taliban. It's a place where even the army can't enter. So Imran Khan is a politician. He is playing politics. And I do think that this latest move of his is more political, more bent on getting international attention to his latest maneuvers, rather than as a long-lasting peace gesture.
And Robert Naiman, how is it that the group that you're with came to choose this particular trip and travel and march drive across part of northern Pakistan, potentially to reach Waziristan? Why did you choose this travel with Imran Khan?
First of all, it was our idea, not Imran Khan's idea. We had the idea, and we convinced Imran Khan to do it. Secondly, and we're very grateful for him to do it, because it wouldn't have been possible for us to do this without his assistance. Secondly, I think I have a totally different take on this question of it being political. I think people say this as a way of dismissing, we can totally ignore this because Imran Khan is a politician and it's political. Hello, this is the way democracy works. This is the way people make social change in democracy, because you get politicians on the side of your issue, and then you push those politicians forward. That's how we ended the Iraq War in the United States. If we didn't have Democrats that were serving as the vehicle for people to push opposition to the Iraq War would still be going. So I'm very grateful that Imran Khan is doing this. This is giving people in Pakistan a vehicle for organizing opposition to the drone strike. Yes, there's a lot of anti-Americanism in Pakistan, and a lot of it is kind of rhetorical posturing that isn't actually doing anything to change Pakistani government policy from kowtowing to the United States. Imran Khan is actually doing something. And I think a lot of people in Pakistan that are kind of armchair leftists are actually jealous of Imran Khan because they didn't do anything, and he's actually doing something. We have the same problem in the United States, you know, armchair leftists that are jealous of people that are actually doing something because they never got out of the coffee shop to do something. So I think this is tremendously positive, and you see the reactions from people. They're very excited that somebody finally is actually doing something, concrete action, to show how things could be different than they've been before. Nobody dared to do this in Pakistan before Imran Khan did it. We're already very close. Maybe we'll be stopped. Maybe we won't. We've already done something that before nobody in Pakistan had the chutzpah to do.
Nafisa Hudboy, are other politicians in Pakistan organizing or popularizing opposition to the U.S. drone strikes and trying to form a sort of affinity with people in the United States?
Well, I don't know about forming affinity in the United States, but of course all the politicians have come out very strongly against the drone attacks. That is true that, you know, because it's generally a very unpopular thing that's happening in Pakistan. But in terms of forming affinity with the United States, you know, I would hate to say so, but there is almost a clash of civilizations right now. And getting people in the United States on board makes politicians automatically suspect because it means that, you know, they are closer to the West. And so politicians are sort of distancing themselves from the West, but at the same time criticizing the drone attacks.
I wonder also, Robert Naiman, what you've seen in Pakistan on your travel this time, this trip, that surprised you as an American that you perhaps hadn't thought about or something you learned new from the Pakistani people so far in your time being there.
Well, I tell you, I've been very pleasantly surprised by the incredibly warm and generous reaction we've gotten. I've always hated this phrase, anti-Americanism, because it conflates two things, opposition to the policies of the United States government and disliking Americans. And you can really, we've really experienced this in the last week, the fact that these are can be two clean different things. We met plenty of people that absolutely despise the policies of the United States government and have nothing against American people, and particularly not us. You know, people are like giving us free meals, and driving us around and helping us in every way and asking what they can do to help us and telling us how much they appreciate our mission, how positive it is, and how they would hope, they hope that other Americans come and do this in the future and see a different picture of Pakistan than the picture that is presented so often in the mainstream U.S. media and politicians in the United States. So I really have experienced in the week that I've been here, and so has everybody else in our delegation, something completely different, a different Pakistan than the Pakistan that is presented in the United States. The people riot against Americans. What we've experienced is tremendous hospitality and support for our mission.
Robert Naiman, what kind of security detail or what kind of police or military do you have traveling along with you, perhaps guarding you or providing protection among the United States people on the bus and the 100 vehicles or so and the over 1,000 people?
Well, I think overwhelmingly the security I've seen is actually security being provided by the PTI, organizing their own security for the march.
They've got that's the party of Imran Khan.
The party of Imran Khan. They've got a lot of experience doing this. South Waziristan, not the only dangerous place in Pakistan. The PTI has organized mass rallies before in Pakistani cities where they were told, oh, you can't go there, it's too dangerous. They did it anyway and successfully organized mass rallies, which I think is testament to the fact that they're well organized and also that they have a lot of popular support. So that makes it easier to do security if the people like you.
Imran Khan has said that the Pakistani government wanted to stop the peace rally, but people in South Waziristan, Imran Khan says, are going to provide security to the peace rally. Have you heard differently? This is according to the Dons reporting this morning, the newspaper, English language newspaper in Pakistan.
If you ask
yes,
me,
actually, let me, Nafisa Hoodboy, would you start, and then I'd like to ask you, Robert, as well. Go ahead, Nafisa.
Yes. The Taliban have backed off any, you know, idea of providing security. They say that they have issued a very scathing criticism of Imran Khan, saying that he's a westernized person and they will not provide him any security. And the JUI, Fazlur Rahman Group, the political party that actually nurtured the Taliban, has said that Imran plans to bring in Jews and Christians through this backdoor. Now, I just like to comment on what was earlier said by the other commentator from Pakistan. is that I think that Imran Khan is basically a politician, so he makes friends with all the kinds of people that would essentially bring him to power. And on the one hand, he has been close to the Taliban. On the other hand, he has never really spoken about their excesses against the people of Pakistan. At the same time, he's never been openly critical of the military, who I know and we know from reporting has had a very dubious relationship with the Taliban. So right now, the kind of area he's exhibited, actually, I don't plan to make this a referendum on Imran Khan, but the fact is that when politicians do things for publicity, they often end up being on the wrong side of everybody. So right now he's in a very difficult spot, being criticized by the Taliban for actually bringing in this peace rally. At the same time, he is getting flak from the other side. So it's not going to be an easy position to be in.
Robert Naiman, I wanted to hear your response too. I just mentioned this phrase, this part of a report from the Dawn newspaper, English Language in Pakistan Today, pointing out that Imran Khan said the government of Pakistan wanted to stop the peace rally, but that the people of South Waziristan were going to secure and allow the rally to happen.
Yeah, this is something that he's been saying, he and others have been saying for some time, that I know this from the NGOs that have been working on this too. They've been having meetings for months with people from South Waziristan, with tribal leaders, with the Malik, explaining this is what we want to do, this is why we want to do it, and building political support. And earlier, you know, there different statements have come out from the Taliban. This is not the first. Of course, there isn't, you know, one Taliban. There's a bunch of different people. But they've had these hostile statements before, but they've also had very supportive statements before, saying, we don't have any problem with this. We understand what Imran Khan is trying to do. We see this as positive, and, you know, we're not going to obstruct any way in and evil of pride security. So part of what made this news was that it was an apparent reversal of what a Taliban spokesman had said before, that we have no problem with this, and we see that it's positive, and we'll help make sure that it's safe. So, and I don't think that it's particularly spectacular, that a spectacular fact that should be surprising, that Imran Khan and the PTI are being opposed from both sides. I think there's a real community of interest between the extreme faction of the Taliban and the government and the extreme secular liberal faction in Pakistan, all of whom benefit from the current conflict and want to maintain it. And Imran Khan represents potentially an alternative, not just Imran Khan, but the whole party, and people who are looking for a political solution instead of a violent confrontation solution, and looking for more distance from the United States, but without looking for a violent solution. That's potentially a threat to every other actor, you know, mainly these three actors, the extreme wing of the Taliban, the extreme secular liberals, and the government that benefit from the status quo. So, of course, there's going to be opposition. But I think the fact that things have even gotten this far, Imran Khan and the protesters and the Americans have been in the Pakistani press all week. This alternative has gotten a platform, this idea of an alternative to the violent status quo has gotten a platform in the Pakistani media that is really unprecedented. And if only for that, it's a tremendous success.
Hey, can I say something?
Please go ahead, Nafisa Hoodboy.
You know, I mean, we have to really go into the background of why Fatah was turned over to the Taliban. I mean, it's all very well to get enthusiastic about trying to stop the drone attacks, but I think one has to step back into history and look at the fact that when the invasion of Afghanistan occurred, the Taliban from Afghanistan went and settled into North and South Waziristan, and they began to murder the landed gentry, the Maliks, who used to control the areas over there. Now, the fact is that the Maliks can no longer live in Fatah. They can't live in North Waziristan. They can't live in South Waziristan. They've all migrated to different parts of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, you know, which is ruled by a secular party, the Awami National Party. But While Imran was taking permission for the rally, he was in touch with the Maliks, with the tribal elders. They are the people who assured him of security for his group, you know, to be able to go into South Waziristan. Those Maliks don't control those areas anymore. Those areas are controlled by the Taliban. And the Taliban are inherently anti-American. They are anti-Jew. They are anti-Christian. And I think they're going to view Imran Khan as representative of all those actors. So, as I said before, being a politician, he's going to get it from all sides. And this may have been a very foolhardy thing to do. And, you know, I hope nothing bad happens. But I think other than being, making a symbolic statement, this really is not going to achieve very much on the ground.
You know, finally, I'd like to ask you both about some of the controversy about this, because the government, perhaps the marchers, had sought a guarantee from the Taliban that it would not attack or target the American activists or the party of Imran Khan, this movement for justice that's traveling into the federally administered tribal area or the tribal regions. The independent newspaper from England, as of yesterday, as of October 5th, was reporting that an apparent statement from the Taliban said that it would not target the activists. But then today, that doesn't seem to be the case. The Dawn newspaper in Pakistan indicating that the Taliban had declined to provide any security to this secular Imran Khan and the American activists traveling with them. Was that surprising to you? First response from Nafisa Hoodboy.
Not at all surprising. It's exactly this kind of thing that they do. They have absolutely no interest in allowing anybody to come in and speak on their behalf. The fact is that through the bad management of the Pakistan military and Pakistan establishment, now North and South Waziristan have been taken over by the Taliban. Absolute control. They do not allow other people to come in territories. And even, you know, the fact is there has been no political party, no political administration allowed in those areas. The politicians don't have a say. They don't have a control over there. So a few peace activists, it's wonderful. It has to be more than that. It has to be a real change in the administration's policy in the United States and inside Pakistan to ensure that the Taliban are controlled, are beaten back, are pressured back. I don't see us going in that direction.
And Robert Naiman, your response?
Well, I would say, first of all, you know, the way that social change happens is that activists organize activities that other people join. It doesn't come from the criticism of armchair leftists in coffee shops. So, yes, of course, 32 or 50 American activists, peace activists, doing these things. The drone strike policy is not going to end tomorrow or next week or next month. But the way that American public opinion is going to turn around is activism. And the way that U.S. policy is going to change is American public opinion and other political pressure. And the thing that many Americans might not realize about Imran Khan and his party is he's currently the most popular Pakistani politician. His party is currently the most popular party. He's doing something right. People know something about politics. And I think I'm also not surprised. The Taliban have gone back and forth because they're divided. In a way, that's a positive thing. There's a contradiction there. On the one hand, they're against the drone strike, so it's hard for them to speak against somebody trying to do something about it. On the other hand, they're a lot of them, at least, are committed to an ideology that change can only happen through violence. So I think for Americans to understand this, it's kind of like the black anarchist or Trotskyist groups that you see in the U.S. that, you know, kind of parasitically attach themselves to mass movements. They actually oppose reformism because it's a threat to their, cliquish power. And I think it's the same thing here. There's a right-wing faction of the Taliban that opposes any attempt to expand the democratic political space in Pakistan in order to solve problems, because that would be a threat to their ideology that change can only happen through violence. So it's not surprising. And in a way, I think the tension is positive because it's showing that there is potentially another path for addressing problems besides violence. Is this going to, you know, transform everything tomorrow? No, it's not. But this is still more than anybody else ever did before. It's opening up a path that other people can follow. And if you saw the enthusiasm, particularly of the young people here, and we had a rally together with the PTI students, and we see many young people on the march, there's this tremendous patriotism and enthusiasm among these young people to try and turn things in. Give an alternative, turn things in Pakistan around, not only address the subservience of the government to the United States, but also the corruption and the failure to bring about improvements for a poor Pakistani, for education, for health care, for providing social services. This is the people thing that people want to see. You know, will Imran Khan and his party do that? Who knows? You can't tell in advance. You know, some people thought that Chavez wasn't real in Venezuela. Turned out he was real. Some people thought Humala was real. Turned out he wasn't real. You can't know then, but there's an opening. And some people in Pakistan are working to to increase the space of this opening. And I think it's a very exciting political development that it's a mistake to be kind of knee-jerk cynical. It's kind of cheap to be and lazy to be knee-jerk cynical. We don't know where this might lead. It's worth exploring the possibility that it could succeed.
Go ahead, Nafisa Hoodboy.
I'd just like to jump in over there. I mean, the thing is that it's not just being armchair. I think that a politician is a politician, and the elections are coming up really close. And this is an issue that's now, hurting a lot of Pakistanis. But the fact of the matter is that people in the United States also need to be better educated about the reasons why the militants have got hold of Waziristan, North Waziristan, South Waziristan, the extent to which the Pakistan military is involved in sustaining them, the extent to which it allowed Imran Khan to hold certain rallies in Pakistan, how it taps into politicians, how it uses them. I think these complexities are really not known to common Americans who don't follow the issues as deeply as somebody who's lived and reported there for years and years can do. So, of course, I mean, we all want peace in the Pak-Afghan border. Who doesn't want peace? I just don't want anybody who's good-hearted and who wants to see genuine change take place in the region get hurt. And I think there are better ways of demonstrating. I think it's a wonderful idea for U.S. peace to come to Pakistan. But I really think that getting them into harm's way is a bad idea. I think that if anything were to happen, and I hope nothing happens, this would really backfire, because the whole point is that we all appreciate U.S. peace activists coming to Pakistan, but let them stay safe while they're there.
Nafisa Hoodboy, do you see strong currents of reform in Pakistan effectively at all held back by extremists?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think, the mindset, the hate that's being taught in schools, we had a study released recently which showed that the hate content in schools, against Christians, Jews, Hindus, and people of other religions is growing. And it always happens in times of war, the hatred towards the other grows. And that's where one should aim at. One should really be going in for education at the grassroots level to say we're all in this together, that, we have to fight together and not through drones and not through bombs, but for peace. So the idea of education, I think, is the one that needs to take place. Unfortunately, politicians are so involved in day-to-day pressures, Imran Khan included, People's Party, you name it, because it's a race just to stay in power in a country like Pakistan. So nobody's really getting into the deep and the nitty-gritty efforts of reforming the educational system and teaching people tolerance for other people of other faiths and other sects and teaching diversity. So I don't see it happening right now.
Robert Naiman, while we still have you on the line in Pakistan, I understand you're traveling and may not be able to be with us for much longer. But there's also a couple of activists, as I understand, traveling with you, two from Massachusetts, in fact, and one from Dartmouth, Massachusetts, Chelsea Faria, and one from Northampton, Pucky Wieland. Do you have a mixture of people from all over the United States traveling with you, England or any other countries?
Yes. Well, our delegation is all Americans except for one Canadian, and from across the United States. There's somebody from Alaska. Several here are people from California, as you mentioned, two people from Massachusetts, I myself, and from Illinois when I'm not from Washington, D.C. So it's people from across the United States, mainly women, and I'm one of the outliers, but people of all ages and backgrounds. And I think that the diversity of our delegation is part of our strength in terms of the different activities we're doing here. We've been meeting with the PTI Women's Division, and we're talking about women's peace activism in Pakistan. Some of the younger people have met with the PTI students, talking about how they're organizing on college campuses in Pakistan and registering youth voters, organizing, educating youth voters, and pushing electoral reform to make it easier for youth to vote. So we do, of course, our mission is focused on ending U.S. drone strikes. But while we're here, of course, we can't help but be interested in Pakistani politics and what people have to say about how they're organizing for reform across the broad range of issues that they're dealing with, which is, of course, not just the drone strike, but also internal reform issues in Pakistan.
Robert Naiman, I want to thank you tremendously for joining us. We're going to stay on the line with Nafisa Hoodboy if we have a few more minutes to just talk about her book about some of this, Aboard the Democracy Train. But as we move on to talk about that democracy train, I want to thank you, Robert Naiman, for joining us from your particular democracy convoy there, we might call it, to coin a phrase. And thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure to speak with you this evening.
That was Robert Naiman joining us from the road there in Pakistan, traveling essentially from Islamabad toward Dera Ismail Khan right now, I believe, on the way there.
Before the area code, please enter your destination number
and
now.
We'll see if we can maintain the line without the long-distance service interruption. But
the number you dialed was not recognized. Please try again. For calls to the United States of Canada, please dial 1 before the area code.
Thanks for staying with us, Nafisa Hoodboy. We're going to try to make a clearer connection. If you have a few more minutes to talk about your book, Aboard the Democracy Train, Nafisa Hoodboy, if we can just ring you back in just a moment, please bear with us.
Rafa no te enamores más de mujeres extranjeras. Ellas enloquecen a los hombres con su mirar. Fíjate cómo a ti te enloqueció esa brasilera, la que conociste una mañana en Valledupar. Por eso Zabaleta como amigo te aconseja que de las extranjeras no te vuelva a enamorar.
Falso, falso.
¿Cómo les parece? ¿Ah? Claro. Yo no puedo decir lo mismo.
You're tuned to WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM, and we are in the midst of speaking with two people on opposite sides of the world, one in Pakistan, an American, Robert Naiman. He was just on the line with us. And now we're joined back again by Pakistani Nafisa Hoodboy, who is actually in the United States in Western Massachusetts now. She's also worked in Washington, D.C. She's a journalist in the United States and had been a staff reporter for the English daily newspaper in Pakistan, Dawn, for 16 years until about year 2000. Her writing often appears in publications from McClatchy newspapers and the Washington Post to Toward Freedom and the Paris Match. Nafisa Hoodbhoy is the author of Aboard the Democracy Train, A Journey Through Pakistan's Last Decade of Democracy. Nafisa Hoodbhoy, thanks for joining us today. It's such a pleasure to have your background and sense for history and background in reporting in Pakistan about this. You know, to take a look at your book, Aboard the Democracy Train, and as we make this transition, how do you see what's been happening on this caravan as being relevant to part of the larger democracy train in Pakistan?
Well, you know, it's great that it is bringing attention to certain things that have been happening in Pakistan since the last 11 years, since 9/11, essentially. And I'm glad that the issue of drone strikes is now coming into focus, because in 2004, when the drone strikes first started, and as was said before, there used to be a highly secretive program, and the Pentagon never even talked about the U.S. being behind the drone strikes. So for it to be talked about so publicly and for people to come out now and express their fears, their apprehensions, you know, is a great step forward. And that's also what my book traces, the fact that drone strikes were secret but have now slowly started being recognized as such a harmful thing for the Pakistani society.
You know, a lot of Americans might not know that in Pakistani society, the Taliban did not always have a strong and prominent presence or role in conflict in or outside of politics. Muslim fundamentalists did not always have a strong and prominent role within Pakistan. You were the only woman reporter under General Zia-ul-Haq in Karachi, mm-hmm. Pakistan. You wrote thousands of news reports during that time. You saw this transition. Tell us about what Pakistan was like just before and just as General Zia came to power in Pakistan in the 80s and 90s.
Right. Well, this is what my book really talks about. It's the transformation of Pakistani society. But, you know, it was already happening when I became a reporter in 1984 in Karachi in the Daily Dawn newspaper. The people who migrated to Pakistan from India, and they were predominantly Muslims who came to create a Pakistani state, a nation based on Islam. And so the Jamaat-e-Islami, the largest Islamic in Pakistan, was already in power in Karachi, and helped to pull the secular head of the government, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the father of Benazir Bhutto, with whom I subsequently traveled and with whom I, you know, whom I wrote about. So the transition was already happening in those years, and Zia-ul-Haq, when he overthrew Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, simply cemented the transition that was happening in society. And in 1977, 5th of July 1977, when he took over, and the constitution that he promulgated was basically a transformation of the secular constitution draft Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, and it took Pakistan down this road to where we are seeing it today. Still, I would say, and I feel tremendously hopeful about this, that Pakistan isn't an Islamic society, that it has a huge reservoir of secularism. But because of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, the fact that militants went across the border and now they have ensconced themselves in other areas and have started to permeate and get inside the Northwest Front province, or the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa as it's now called, they've also begun to infiltrate parts of the job. They are now in the small towns of Pakistan. And their thinking, it's their thinking which is now permeating to middle-class Pakistanis, which, you know, has created this distrust of Americans. And that is the thing that I suspect will be much more harmful in the long run for Pakistan.
If I understood you correctly, you're saying there's a big reservoir of secularism in Pakistan among the people of Pakistan. That is a sense of what we call in America separation of church and state. Although there are certainly fundamentalist Christians in the United States who would like to merge those two tomorrow if we could. But we're talking about Pakistan. You mentioned that some of a different kind of thinking is permeating the middle class in Pakistan, which is also a different phenomenon, the middle class there, than it is in the United States, I assume, and in different numbers. But how do you see that developing? Do you mean a more fundamentalist or those wanting to see more Islamic principles in the Pakistani legal system?
Different things that are happening. I would say that, first of all, when the veil comes in and women start to observe the parda, that's also a sort of a knee-jerk reaction against the West. And that has happened much more strongly in the last 11 years. And it's precisely because of the absence of justice in society. And the fact is that, of course, Islam speaks about principles of justice. But when people pick up Islam, they pick up en masse and without really thought, and they simply go for the form rather than the content. So women will begin to observe the parda. Men will start to sport beards.
And I have to ask you to define that term. To women observe the parda, most Americans don't know what that means.
They cover their heads. They cover their bodies because, you know, women start feeling much more conscious about being sexual objects. So they begin to cover themselves much more closely, and that's really a form of anti-Westernism because it's supposed to be a principle of Islam that women cover themselves. And so it's going form rather than the essence of Islam, which talks about humanity and socialistic principles of equality and justice. But I think mostly people go for the routine or the form rather than for what's really enshrined in the religion. So this is the kind of thing we've been seeing, even though if you were to look at Pakistani society, the Islamic parties have never been able to win more than 3% of the vote. What people really want is what people all over the world want. They want the right to have jobs, the right to work, justice in society, a crackdown on miscreants, because Pakistan is racked by violence, because bombs, sectarian attacks, killing, looters, fraudulent people, they've all come out. And this happens when a country is at war. Pakistan has been at war for years, and it's brought out all the negative things from society and brought it into the mainstream.
I'm curious to ask you, when General Zia, as he's known, Zia-ul-Haq, came into power in Pakistan, was he supported by the United States?
Absolutely, absolutely. The United States supported General Zia because the Soviets were in neighboring Afghanistan, and General Zia was in the forefront of the fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. So actually, when that happened, the Mujahideen or the Afghans who lived in Afghanistan and who were really disturbed by the Soviet presence in Afghanistan migrated into Pakistan. 3 million of them, and they became the Mujahideen. And General Zia served as the conduit for the United States to arm and fund the Mujahideen against the Russians in Afghanistan.
And what had relations been like between the United States and the previous Prime Minister of Pakistan, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, Benazir Bhutto's father?
Yes, well, relations were not always good, but because Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was interested in developing the bomb, and of course he had ambitions for the Islamic countries. He was the first prime minister to hold the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Countries Summit in 1973. And so he was also viewed as one of the leaders who might unite the Islamic countries. And, of course, going in for the bomb was never popular with the United States.
And yet, isn't it true that also that Prime Minister Bhutto, Benazir Bhutto's father, before General Zia took over power in Pakistan, he although what you just said is true, he did not impose Islamic law on Pakistan. Is that right?
That's correct. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was a secular leader. He had been educated in Berkeley, California. He did not want to see the imposition of Islamic law inside Pakistan because, as I mentioned, the history of Pakistan was such that the influx of Muslims from India into Pakistan, Pakistan was partitioned in 1947 from India, and the British left India soon after that. So the influx of people from India into Pakistan or people who came to create a Muslim state in Pakistan, they were the people who began to organize against Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. And being held under in those days, and in 1977, finally, the Pakistan National Alliance, the groups of Islamic parties opposed to Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's secular rule, toppled him. And that's when, the segue was created for General Zia-ul-Haq to step in, impose martial law, and it's been downhill since then.
But General Zia, backed by the United States, overthrew this secular leader, this Prime Minister Bhutto, who did not impose Islamic law. General Zia brought Islamic law, brought the anti-blasphemy laws. General Zia did this supported by the United States, right?
Correct. Yes. Yes, and that's why people are bitter. You know, people who know history are bitter that the Mujahideen were actually supported by the United States. And that was the beginning of fundamentalism inside Pakistan, to have this heavily armed Mujahideen group supported by the United States, and to have a military ruler imposing Sharia law and holding it over the heads of the people, and to have that supported by the United States. You can see the irony of the situation where these Mujahideen and then subsequently the Taliban turned against the United States, and now the U.S. is on a different side compared to Pakistan. But as people in Pakistan know, history testifies that the militants and the Mujahideen and the Islamic warriors were brought in by the United States.
Or at least backed by them, would you say? Or do you mean brought in literally?
Literally, in the sense that the money that was funded to through the ISI or the secret wing of the ISI was given to the most hardline Islamic militants, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. Osama bin Laden actually found that a wonderful place to come and set up shop, because the most hardline Islamic militants were then converged in Pakistan and actually in the hard areas. And so the jihadists from all over the world, including Arab militants, Uzbek, Chechens, Uyghurs, you name it, they all found a Mecca in the Fatah areas of Pakistan. And that's where the beginning of the jihad took place.
Of course, we should mention that it was the military under General Zia who had the previous prime minister executed. Later, it was different elements, we assume, who executed his daughter, who was a female leader, elected leader of Pakistan for many years, Benazir Bhutto. Is that right?
Yes. Benazir was the first woman prime minister of Pakistan, twice elected. In fact, this is where my book starts, that in 1988, when General Zia-ul-Haq was killed in a plane crash, I, being the only woman reporter in the Dawn newspaper, was appointed to cover her and traveled with her throughout Sindh and even parts of the... and saw how millions of people came out to greet her and helped her become the first woman prime minister of Pakistan. She was twice elected and killed in 2007. But that's where another story begins. And of course, I have covered that in the latter part of my book as well.
The book is Aboard the Democracy Train, A Journey Through Pakistan's Last Decade of Democracy. I wonder, Nafisa Hoodboy, how you see the conflicts and fights within Pakistani politics. How much of it is torn apart by the United States military involvement, the drone strikes, the attacks, the war in Pakistan, or is that a sideshow?
No, it's not a sideshow. I would say that, you know, U.S. politics have completely changed the politics of Pakistan. It's been like this. You must know that the Pakistan military has been growing apart, has been growing away from the United States military since the last 2 or 3 years. This is because now it's the demand of the people of Pakistan to sever ties with the United States. Whose fault it is, nobody knows, but as I said, it's been really bad management of the politics inside Pakistan, which has led the south and north Waziristan area now being totally occupied by Taliban. The fact that Al-Qaeda still finds it a hospitable area in which to launch attacks, you know, has complicated things. U.S. policy in Afghanistan has spilled over, and the great fear of the secular elements inside Pakistan is that these militants will slowly penetrate into the urban areas of Pakistan. In 2009, the Taliban had almost created a state within a state in the Swat area of the northwest frontier province, now called Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, and they had begun to implement their own Sharia law. It was only when the Pakistan military went in that the Taliban was to go over the border and go into Afghanistan. But given how strong they are, not only in the Waziristan area, but also parts of the settled areas of Pakistan and the Punjab, and even Balochistan, which is today the most lawless province in Pakistan, the fears amongst Pakistanis is that the Taliban will eventually begin, you know, knocking on the door of Islamabad. And already we are seeing, you know, certain things that are headed in that direction.
I'm curious how the Taliban came to such power. Al-Qaeda, Taliban supporting Al-Qaeda to some extent, although they have conflicts between themselves. Do you think it was really at the spurring of by U.S. attacks that the Taliban were able to maintain such power in Pakistan, or at least influence over politics? Or are they just a remote armed force that happens to have a global impact?
Well, you know, it's complex, but the fact is the Taliban are Pashtuns, and they live on both sides of the Pakistan and Afghanistan border. So they straddle the border just like, you know, it's one country for them. And a war is a terrible thing, and the war has gone on for, you know, more than 11 years in Afghanistan. So the Taliban over there have become increasingly resilient and are starting to be backed by the local population who, because of the corruption within the Karzai government, are headed towards the Taliban, because the Taliban at least promise law and order and justice. So it's a losing fight that the U.S. has now in Afghanistan, and Pakistan is now seeing the same Taliban or the people of Afghanistan across the border, and make their safe haven inside North and South Waziristan, which are essentially trapped affairs and over which the government of Pakistan has no control. So it's happened over a period of 11 years. I would say that war and the fact that Afghans will fight for 1,000 years has just made matter grow worse, and has, you know, the Afghanistan war has spilled over and created this deep sense of militancy that we are seeing now in Pakistan.
Nafisa Hoodboy, I'm curious to ask you something about Imran Khan, something he said recently. This is the Pakistani politician who is on the road with perhaps 1,000 Pakistanis and 30 Americans, a Canadian and an English person, a British person. Imran Khan is leading this travel to raise awareness and to oppose the drone strikes. He's also, of course, a politician heading toward election and doing things as politicians do for publicity. But he said recently, and the BBC, the British broadcaster, I believe it was BBC Radio 4, their program called Today, he said that he would authorize the shooting down of U.S. drones over Pakistan if he became head of the government because those drone strikes violate Pakistan's sovereignty. They're apparently not done with official permission from the Pakistani government or military, although there's wavering on that. But what do you make of Imran Khan saying he would authorize shooting down U.S. drones? That has not happened before, as far as I know, in Pakistan. The Pakistan prime minister and military have not yet shot down U.S. drones, if I'm correct on that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, essentially, I think Imran Khan has recognized that the Taliban are a force to be reckoned with. And the Taliban are deeply opposed to the drone strikes because they have happened mostly in North Waziristan, which is where the Taliban have now set up their strongholds. So essentially, I think Imran Khan recognizes that there are only two forces in Pakistan. One is the Taliban and the other is the military. And because the military itself recognizes the Taliban as a force. So Imran Khan is saying things which are popular amongst the people of the Safa areas and in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. He's essentially speaking like a politician, which is why he made a statement like that.
He is speaking as a politician. Do you think that, would you estimate that that statement is gained, that Imran Khan might make a statement like that, that he would shoot down U.S. drones if he were elected? Is that something aimed at the Taliban to get their favor or aimed at the Pakistani middle class or other elements in Pakistan?
Well, given how unpopular drone strikes are, you know, throughout Pakistan, I think that he hopes to gain the support of everyone, but particularly the Taliban. And given that the Taliban are a strong force in the Waziristan area, yes, that statement is certainly meant to gain their support.
Well, Nafisa Hoodboy, I thank you tremendously for joining us today, and we look forward to learning more about your work and your book, Aboard the Democracy Train. Nafisa Hoodboy, thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. Bye-bye.
Nafisa Hoodboy is a journalist in the United States. Her writing appears in the McClatchy newspapers and the Washington Post, also Toward Freedom and the Paris Match, among other places. She was a staff reporter for the English daily newspaper in Pakistan, Dawn, for 16 years. She was the only woman reporter under General Zia in Karachi, Pakistan, and she's the author of Aboard the Democracy Train. The book's full title is Aboard the Democracy Train, A Journey Through Pakistan's Last Decade of Democracy. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm John Grebe. You've been tuned to WZBC Newton, 90.3 FM. Thanks for bearing with us as we troubleshoot a few of our, a little bit of audio distortion, perhaps in our air signal. You can listen to our programs for the last 2 weeks and a clear version of them from our streams linked from WZBC.org, ZBCOnline.com. Stay tuned for Sports Saturday coming up ahead. My name's John Grebe. For myself and Amy Grunder, thanks for joining us today. You can reach us after the program at 617-552-3511. Again, 617-552-3511. Stay tuned for Sports Saturday.